again, I knew what I was doing. And time again, it just made things worse. It seemed you see the most of what is really true, and you're stepping into your hurts. The only time you can write a song that's really, really real. The best a man can say is how.
You might say it's a very American story. A young man with literary dreams runs away from his rural home and his past, setting off for New York to become a writer. Once he gets here, he self-publishes a literary magazine, holds a series of odd jobs, and lives in various tenement apartments. And when his friend Tom arrives in the city, they change their names, create new personas, form a band, and help define a generation. In his latest book, I was a very clean tramp, an autobiography, Richard Hell, formerly Richard Myers, recalls in unflinching detail his life as a junkie, punk rock icon, literary outlaw, and survivor. It's published by Echo, and I'm very pleased to welcome Richard Hell back to our show. Hello.
Hey. Hi.
Come to think of it, it could also sound like a very French story, a collaboration of Balzac and Baudelaire set in late 19th century Paris. Is that why Tom Miller changed his name to Verlaine?
No. And as a matter of fact, though, when you described it as an American story, yeah, the publisher did the same thing on the flap to the book, a classic American story of leaving the backwoods to come to the big city. But no, I don't see that as especially American. And frankly, those writers did play a big role in creating my idea of things, but. When we were changing our names, we decided when we were forming a band that we wanted to, or at least I did, have every aspect of the band play a role in the sort of messages that we were trying to convey.
Even your names.
Yeah. Names, haircuts, interviews.
But he didn't become Tom Rambeau. He became Tom Verlaine.
Well, I'll tell you how that happened. I'd picked my name. I decided on Hell.
And I feel uncomfortable, I have to admit, calling you Mr. Hell.
Yeah. There was actually a couple of cases way back in the early days when they wouldn't do it in certain media, which is excessive.
Is it your legal name now?
No. I never made it my legal name. I like to have – it's handy to have as many – identities as possible, So I use Myers but I always use Hell when I'm making restaurant reservations.
Because they'll know that name.
So I chose Hell, and then I had the idea just because it was pretty that he take a name from a 19th century French poet. We were both kind of inspired by writers from that era and place. And my first idea was Gautier, but I realized that there would be a pronunciation problem. And he said Verlaine, and that sounded perfect. Not for anything to do with Rambeau, but because Verlaine himself was this sort of archetypal bohemian wreck, but who also wrote, his poetry was really subtle and lyrical, and ethereal. So it was a nice mix.
I don't know a lot of lines of poetry, but I do know one of his lines. It rains in my heart as it rains in the street. It was just such a beautiful image.
That's actually, that poem is dedicated to Rambeau. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned backwoods Kentucky. Lexington, Kentucky, that's not really backwoods, is it?
In fact, compared to New York, it
isn't Lexington home to a prison for drug abusers?
Yeah, I don't know if that still exists, but it did when I was growing up. Burroughs was there for a while. Mm-hmm. How was it referred to in Lexington? It was called the Veterans Hospital or something like that. It wasn't really acknowledged, but yeah.
But you don't see any irony in the fact that you grew up in a town where they sent people who were arrested for drug abuse. After all, what happened with you later?
Well, Lexington does have, the hospital thing is kind of negative. I mean, I associate that with a prison. They often send prisoners there. They often send addicts who've been arrested. But it also has this kind of underground, which I wasn't really aware of when I was growing up, but there's a whole gay culture there. Though there was this guy who we used to see on the streets that it always gave me pleasure to see him across the street, this really queeny aide at the hospital who was always really flamboyantly dressed. He was called Sweet Evening Breeze. That was his name. That's how he called himself. And then later, when I grew up, and one of one of Cormac McCarthy's books, I think maybe it was Sutri, which is set in Knoxville. There's a scene where a guy talks about having just returned from Lexington and having had a conversation with Sweet Evening Breeze. It was great.
Now, running away is a theme that runs through your boyhood and adolescence. You just did it again and again. Why?
You know, it's hard for me to tell how extreme that behavior was. I mean, maybe I'm exaggerating in my own mind. Maybe everybody does that, runs away every year, or whose favorite recreation is to run away. But yeah, it did happen. I did usually plan some kind of runaway every year, 18 months, until I finally succeeded when I was, I turned 17.
Well, you met Tom Miller when you were in prep school?
Uh-huh.
Did you plan to run away together?
Well,
because it's a kind of strong Tom Sawyer.
I was in prep school for like less than a year, right? I mean, I'd had a scholarship when I was in Kentucky to the local private school for a little while. And then when we moved away from Lexington for the last year I spent with my family, they moved to Virginia and they sent me to, sort of routinely to the big public school that was there. And I was so miserable, not knowing anybody, and it was really huge. And I was dissatisfied with everything anyway. And I'd gotten accustomed to the sort of pampering of small classes and a little school where you knew everybody. And I, made life so bad for my mom that she found a school that would accept me despite my really bad record in school. This boarding school in Delaware. I was there for less than a year. But Tom was going there, and I started getting into trouble again. I took some psychedelic drugs and kind of made a spectacle of myself, and they suspended me.
Now, you didn't go to Washington. You came to New York. I guess that's where an aspiring writer would come. So how did you survive in the city? You were still very young.
It was easier to get by then. There was never any question of surviving or not. I could take care of myself, but life sure was simpler and more congenial for a kid who'd come to Manhattan in those days than it is now. Apartment rents were so cheap that it was my policy to get an apartment, never for more than $100-$125 a month, and keep it until I ran out of money, and then I'd have 2 months before the landlord could legally evict me. And I'd find another apartment, within 3 or 4 days of when I wanted one. And so it just, and it worked the same way with jobs. I'd take a job until I just couldn't tolerate it anymore, try to save up a little bit of money to hold me for another few weeks before I had to look for a new
job. And how much writing were you doing at this time?
I regarded myself as a writer, but I pretty much had to, I was self-taught. mostly by reading and turning out, you know, as much as I could. Though I found it, I felt really self-conscious as a writer. It was a long slog. It felt like, though, you know, in retrospect, it doesn't look as long. In those days, you know, when you're that young, time is different. You know, a year lasts for 10 years. So, but it took me a good 3 or 4 years before I wrote anything I really felt as if it was adequate.
And who are you influenced by?
Influenced by it was a big mixture, but I would say,
because you were self-taught, that's you were reading people, and
probably Lautremont was a hugely important, maybe the most important, but also this whole kind of approach to poetry, because in those days I was writing poetry and, you know, thought of myself as a poet. I was aspiring to be a poet anyway. I was just as much inspired by the New York poets. For me, mostly the second generation ones, the first generation being John Asbury and Frank O'Hara and Kenneth Koch and James Schuyler. But the second generation were these kids that had been greatly influenced by who were like street kids in the Lower East Side.
And then I guess the poetry led you to form your first band.
No, rejecting the poetry led me to form my first band.
You've actually been described as the originator of punk. Now, no one person could originate punk, but was there really a punk scene at the time?
No. I mean, what do you mean?
So did you really originate it?
Well, no. I didn't originate it, but I brought certain tropes. I mean, like the haircut and ripped shirts and, you know, the song Blank Generation, which captured a certain kind of, you know, certain attitude that was typical of what would become punk. This was like in 1973, 1974.
Blank Generation, kind of a riff on The Who's My Generation.
Well, in fact, I mean, I thought of it in those terms, more or less. I mean, I saw this kind of genre of generation songs. The other song that I saw in that kind of stream was Blue Suede Shoes. Like that caught the rockabilly for me, and the attitude of those kids. But the song was actually half a joke that was a kind of appropriation riff on this obscure, silly novelty song from the 60s called I Belong to the Beat Generation, written by Rod McEwen.
Now, my guess is, well, Rod McEwen, probably a major influence on your poetry. Richard Hell, his latest book, I Dreamed I Was a Very Clean Tramp, an autobiography. You've written memoirs in the past.
I've never written a memoir.
Well, you were here before to talk about your...
A novel.
Uh-huh. Oh, a novel that was kind of semi-autobiographical. And now...
Well, no more than any person's first novel. I mean, it was, you know, I mean, it took into account a lot of my own experience, but it was by no means a memoir. It was a novel.
And in this case, you're pretty frank about your life, about your drug use.
Well, why would you write an autobiography if you're not going to be frank?
Well, there are a lot of people who try to protect their images. Autobiographies have often... Ben Franklin lied in the very first autobiography ever written.
I'm sure I'll be accused of lying.
So you started this band with Tom Berlin.
In fact, sometimes I wonder if I made up the whole thing.
Television wasn't the first band, was it? It was Neon Boys?
Yeah, we had a band that we weren't able to really fully complete. We couldn't find another guitar player, though we wrote a bunch of songs and we ended up recording some of them, so we never played live. But yeah, it gets some play called the Neon Boys, yeah. But the Television was the band that... was the first one, you know, was the one that made waves. But I left that band before they recorded, and I have absolutely no role in their record. You know, I mean, it was just But that moment when I was in the band was influential.
Well, it was the CBGB time with Patti Smith, the Ramones, and others. And
yeah, but so are my later bands. Like, I mean, the band that with which I made an album that's really, you know, my credentials as a musician is Richard Hell and the Voidoids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, there was in between. There was Johnny Thunder. There was the Heartbreakers with Johnny Thunders. When you mentioned that look, how conscious were you of creating an image when you began cutting your own hair, wearing ripped T-shirts?
Well, as I was saying before, it was. Very
and does
calculated.
It bother you when you go to the suburbs and you see stores actually selling that kind of stuff today?
No, it doesn't bother me. I mean, I moved beyond that. It's. That's talking about 30 years ago. But all of those sort of all those appearance, personal appearance, sort of presentations were really calculated. I thought them through. I mean, I wanted them to have meaning.
Okay, and so. Then you saw other people starting to dress like that. The Sex Pistols, for example. Do you think that the Sex Pistols and other British punk rockers were kind of not doing knockoffs of what you were doing?
Well, it's not really an issue. I mean, the guy Malcolm McLaren, who was the person who dressed the Sex Pistols, had been in New York, and he's talked about it often how. He was taken by the way I looked and behaved, and that he used that in his clothing designs and his concept for the Sex Pistols and the way he dressed the Sex Pistols.
You write very openly about your drug use and how it got in the way of your music at times. How were you able to tour in the United States and Europe while maintaining a heroin habit?
I didn't do very much touring, partly for that reason, though I didn't like touring anyway. I mean, it's really boring. I don't think that I'm really cut out to be a touring professional musician.
We're kind of out of time, but you did clean up.
Yep.
And then you quit making music. Do you ever think about going back to making music, or are you just a full-time writer today? Not that I should have said just. Are you a full-time writer today?
I am a full-time writer. I would play music if it was only making records.
And what about this? The title of this book, I Dreamed I Was a Very Clean Tramp.
Well, that's sort of revealed in the course of the first couple of chapters.
We'll leave it for readers to discover that. I Dreamed I Was a Very Clean Tramp, an autobiography published by Echo. My great thanks to Richard Hell for being here. And he has three events coming up. He'll be reading and signing books Thursday at 7 at the Union Square Barnes & Noble, on Friday at 7 at the Book Review in Huntington, Long Island, and on Tuesday the 19th at 6 at Bookmark at 400 Bleecker Street. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.